A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. Chapter 1. Camelot. Camelot, Camelot, said I to myself. I don't seem to remember hearing of it before. Name of the asylum, likely. It was a soft, reposeful summer landscape, as lovely as a dream, and as lonesome as Sunday. The air was full of the smell of flowers, and the buzzing of insects, and the twittering of birds, and there were no people, no wagons, there was no stir of life, nothing going on. The road was mainly a winding path with hoof prints in it, and now and then a faint trace of wheels on either side in the grass, wheels that apparently had a tire as broad as one's hand. Presently a fair slip of a girl, about 10 years old, with a cataract of golden hair streaming down over her shoulders, came along. Around her head she wore a hoop of flame-red poppies. It was as sweet an outfit as ever I saw, what there was of it. She walked indolently along, with a mind at rest, its peace reflected in her innocent face. The circus man paid no attention to her, didn't even seem to see her. And she was no more startled at his fantastic makeup than if she was used to his like every day of her life. She was going by as indifferently as she might have gone by a couple of cows, but when she happened to notice me, then there was a change. Up went her hands, and she was turned to stone, her mouth dropped open, her eyes stared wide and timorously, she was the picture of astonished curiosity touched with fear. And there she stood gazing, in a sort of stupefied fascination, till we turned a corner of the wood and were lost to her view. That she should be startled at me instead of at the other man, was too many for me, I couldn't make head or tail of it. And that she should seem to consider me a spectacle, and totally overlook her own merits in that respect, was another puzzling thing, and a display of magnanimity, too, that was surprising in one so young. There was food for thought here. I moved along as one in a dream. As we approached the town, signs of life began to appear. At intervals we passed a wretched cabin, with a thatched roof, and about it small fields and garden patches in an indifferent state of cultivation. There were people, too, brawny men, with long, coarse, uncombed hair that hung down over their faces and made them look like animals. They and the women, as a rule, wore a coarse tow linen robe that came well below the knee, and a rude sort of sandal, and many wore an iron collar. The small boys and girls were always naked, but nobody seemed to know it. All of these people stared at me, talked about me, ran into the huts and fetched out their families to gape at me, but nobody ever noticed that other fellow, except to make him humble salutation and get no response for their pains. In the town were some substantial windowless houses of stone scattered among a wilderness of thatched cabins, the streets were mere crooked alleys, and unpaved, troops of dogs and nude children played in the sun and made life and noise, hogs roamed and rooted contentedly about, and one of them lay in a reeking wallow in the middle of the main thoroughfare and suckled her family. Presently there was a distant blare of military music, it came nearer, still nearer, and soon a noble cavalcade wound into view, glorious with plumed helmets and flashing mail and flaunting banners and rich doublets and horsecloths and gilded spearheads, and through the muck and swine, and naked brats, and joyous dogs, and shabby huts, it took its gallant way, and in its wake we followed. Followed through one winding alley and then another, and climbing, always climbing till at last we gained the breezy height where the huge castle stood. There was an exchange of bugle blasts, then a parley from the walls, where men-at-arms, in hauberk and morion, marched back and forth with halberd at shoulder under flapping banners with the rude figure of a dragon displayed upon them, and then the great gates were flung open, the drawbridge was lowered, and the head of the cavalcade swept forward under the frowning arches, and we, following, soon found ourselves in a great paved court, with towers and turrets stretching up into the blue air on all the four sides, and all about us the dismount was going on, and much greeting and ceremony, and running to and fro, and a gay display of moving and intermingling colors, and an altogether pleasant stir and noise and confusion. Chapter 2. King Arthur's Court. The moment I got a chance I slipped aside privately and touched an ancient common-looking man on the shoulder and said, in an insinuating, confidential way, "Friend, do me a kindness. Do you belong to the asylum, or are you just on a visit or something like that?" He looked me over stupidly, and said, "Marry, fair sir, me seemeth." "That will do," I said, "I reckon you are a patient." I moved away, cogitating, and at the same time keeping an eye out for any chance passenger in his right mind that might come along and give me some light. I judged I had found one, presently, so I drew him aside and said in his ear, "If I could see the head keeper a minute only just a minute. Prithee do not let me."
"Let you what?"
"Hinder me, then, if the word please thee better." Then he went on to say he was an undercook and could not stop to gossip, though he would like it another time, for it would comfort his very liver to know where I got my clothes. As he started away, he pointed and said, "Yonder was one who was idle enough for my purpose, and was seeking me besides, no doubt." This was an airy slim boy in shrimp-colored tights that made him look like a forked carrot. The rest of his gear was blue silk and dainty laces and ruffles, and he had long yellow curls, and wore a plumed pink satin cap tilted complacently over his ear. By his look, he was good-natured, by his gait, he was satisfied with himself. He was pretty enough to frame. He arrived, looked me over with a smiling and impudent curiosity, said he had come for me, and informed me that he was a page. "Go along," I said, "you ain't more than a paragraph." It was pretty severe, but I was nettled. However, it never fazed him, he didn't appear to know he was hurt. He began to talk and laugh, in happy, thoughtless, boyish fashion, as we walked along, and made himself old friends with me at once, asked me all sorts of questions about myself and about my clothes, but never waited for an answer, always chattered straight ahead, as if he didn't know he had asked a question and wasn't expecting any reply, until at last he happened to mention that he was born in the beginning of the year 513. It made the cold chills creep over me. I stopped and said, a little faintly, "Maybe I didn't hear you just right. Say it again and say it slow. What year was it?" 513. 513. You don't look it. Come, my boy, I am a stranger and friendless, be honest and honorable with me. Are you in your right mind?" He said he was. "Are these other people in their right minds?" He said they were. "And this isn't an asylum? I mean, it isn't a place where they cure crazy people?" He said it wasn't. "Well, then," I said, "either I am a lunatic, or something just as awful has happened. Now tell me, honest and true, where am I?" "In King Arthur's court." I waited a minute, to let that idea shudder its way home, and then said, "And according to your notions, what year is it now?" 528, 19th of June. I felt a mournful sinking at the heart, and muttered, "I shall never see my friends again, never, never again. They will not be born for more than 1300 years yet." I seemed to believe the boy, I didn't know why. Something in me seemed to believe in my consciousness, as you may say, but my reason didn't. My reason straightway began to clamor, that was natural. I didn't know how to go about satisfying it, because I knew that the testimony of men wouldn't serve. My reason would say they were lunatics, and throw out their evidence. But all of a sudden I stumbled on the very thing, just by luck. I knew that the only total eclipse of the sun in the first half of the 6th century occurred on the 21st of June, AD 528, OS, and began at 3 minutes after 12 noon. I also knew that no total eclipse of the sun was due in what to me was the present year I.E., 1879. So, if I could keep my anxiety and curiosity from eating the heart out of me for 48 hours, I should then find out for certain whether this boy was telling me the truth or not. Wherefore, being a practical Connecticut man, I now shoved this whole problem clear out of my mind till its appointed day and hour should come, in order that I might turn all my attention to the circumstances of the present moment, and be alert and ready to make the most out of them that could be made. "One thing at a time," is my motto, and just play the thing for all it is worth, even if it's only two pair and a jack. I made up my mind to two things. If it was still the 19th century and I was among lunatics and couldn't get away, I would presently boss that asylum or know the reason why, and if, on the other hand, it was really the 6th century, all right, I didn't want any softer thing, I would boss the whole country inside of 3 months, for I judged I would have the start of the best educated man in the kingdom by a matter of 1300 years and upward. I'm not a man to waste time after my mind's made up and there's work on hand, so I said to the page, "Now, Clarence, my boy, if that might happen to be your name, I'll get you to post me up a little if you don't mind. What is the name of that apparition that brought me here?" "My master and thine? That is the good knight and great lord Sir Kay the Seneschal, foster brother to our liege the king." "Very good, go on, tell me everything." He made a long story of it, but the part that had immediate interest for me was this. He said I was Sir Kay's prisoner, and that in the due course of custom I would be flung into a dungeon and left there on scant commons until my friends ransomed me unless I chanced to rot first. I saw that the last chance had the best show, but I didn't waste any bother about that, time was too precious. The page said, further, that dinner was about ended in the great hall by this time, and that as soon as the sociability and the heavy drinking should begin, Sir Kay would have me in and exhibit me before King Arthur and his illustrious knights seated at the table round, and would brag about his exploit in capturing me, and would probably exaggerate the facts a little, but it wouldn't be good form for me to correct him, and not over safe, either, and when I was done being exhibited, then ho for the dungeon. But he, Clarence, would find a way to come and see me every now and then, and cheer me up, and help me get word to my friends. I thanked him, I couldn't do less, and about this time a lackey came to say I was wanted, so Clarence led me in and took me off to one side and sat down by me. Well, it was a curious kind of spectacle, and interesting. It was an immense place, and rather naked, yes, and full of loud contrasts. It was very, very lofty, so lofty that the banners depending from the arched beams and girders away up there floated in a sort of twilight. There was a stone-railed gallery at each end, high up, with musicians in the one, and women, clothed in stunning colors, in the other. The floor was of big stone flags laid in black and white squares, rather battered by age and use, and needing repair. As to ornament, there wasn't any, strictly speaking, though on the walls hung some huge tapestries which were probably taxed as works of art. Battle pieces, they were, with horses shaped like those which children cut out of paper or create in gingerbread, with men on them in scale armor whose scales are represented by round holes so that the man's coat looks as if it had been done with a biscuit punch. There was a fireplace big enough to camp in, and its projecting sides and hood, of carved and pillared stonework, had the look of a cathedral door. Along the walls stood men-at-arms, in breastplate and morion, with halberds for their only weapon, rigid as statues, and that is what they looked like. In the middle of this groined and vaulted public square was an oaken table which they called the Table Round. It was as large as a circus ring, and around it sat a great company of men dressed in such various and splendid colors that it hurt one's eyes to look at them. They wore their plumed hats, right along, except that whenever one addressed himself directly to the king, he lifted his hat a trifle just as he was beginning his remark. Mainly they were drinking from entire ox horns, but a few were still munching bread or gnawing beef bones. There was about an average of 2 dogs to 1 man, and these sat in expectant attitudes till a spent bone was flung to them, and then they went for it by brigades and divisions, with a rush, and there ensued a fight which filled the prospect with a tumultuous chaos of plunging heads and bodies and flashing tails, and the storm of howlings and barkings deafened all speech for the time. But that was no matter, for the dogfight was always a bigger interest anyway. The men rose, sometimes, to observe it the better and bet on it, and the ladies and the musicians stretched themselves out over their balusters with the same object, and all broke into delighted ejaculations from time to time. In the end, the winning dog stretched himself out comfortably with his bone between his paws, and proceeded to growl over it, and gnaw it, and grease the floor with it, just as 50 others were already doing, and the rest of the court resumed their previous industries and entertainments. As a rule, the speech and behavior of these people were gracious and courtly, and I noticed that they were good and serious listeners when anybody was telling anything, I mean in a dog-fightless interval. And plainly, too, they were a childlike and innocent lot, telling lies of the stateliest pattern with a most gentle and winning naivety, and ready and willing to listen to anybody else's lie, and believe it, too. It was hard to associate them with anything cruel or dreadful, and yet they dealt in tales of blood and suffering with a guileless relish that made me almost forget to shudder. I was not the only prisoner present. There were 20 or more. Poor devils, many of them were maimed, hacked, carved, in a frightful way, and their hair, their faces, their clothing, were caked with black and stiff and drenchings of blood. They were suffering sharp physical pain, of course, and weariness, and hunger and thirst, no doubt, and at least none had given them the comfort of a wash, or even the poor charity of a lotion for their wounds, yet you never heard them utter a moan or groan, or saw them show any sign of restlessness, or any disposition to complain. The thought was forced upon me, the rascals, they have served other people so in their day, it being their own turn, now, they were not expecting any better treatment than this, so their philosophical bearing is not an outcome of mental training, intellectual fortitude, reasoning, it is mere animal training, they are white Indians. Chapter 3. Knights of the Table Round. Mainly the round table talk was monologues, narrative accounts of the adventures in which these prisoners were captured and their friends and backers killed and stripped of their steeds and armor. As a general thing, as far as I could make out, these murderous adventures were not forays undertaken to avenge injuries, nor to settle old disputes or sudden fallings out. No, as a rule they were simply duels between strangers, duels between people who had never even been introduced to each other, and between whom existed no cause of offense whatever. Many a time I had seen a couple of boys, strangers, meet by chance, and say simultaneously, "I can lick you," and go at it on the spot. But I had always imagined until now that that sort of thing belonged to children only, and was a sign and mark of childhood, but here were these big boobies sticking to it and taking pride in it clear up into full age and beyond. Yet there was something very engaging about these great simple-hearted creatures, something attractive and lovable. There did not seem to be brains enough in the entire nursery, so to speak, to bait a fishhook with, but you didn't seem to mind that, after a little, because you soon saw that brains were not needed in a society like that, and indeed would have marred it, hindered it, spoiled its symmetry, perhaps rendered its existence impossible. There was a fine manliness observable in almost every face, and in some a certain loftiness and sweetness that rebuked your belittling criticisms and stilled them. A most noble benignity and purity reposed in the countenance of him they called Sir Galahad, and likewise in the king's also, and there was majesty and greatness in the giant frame and high bearing of Sir Launcelot of the Lake. There was presently an incident which centered the general interest upon this Sir Launcelot. At a sign from a sort of master of ceremonies, 6 or 8 of the prisoners rose and came forward in a body and knelt on the floor and lifted up their hands toward the ladies' gallery and begged the grace of a word with the queen. The most conspicuously situated lady in that massed flower bed of feminine show and finery inclined her head by way of assent, and then the spokesman of the prisoners delivered himself and his fellows into her hands for free pardon, ransom, captivity, or death, as she in her good pleasure might elect, and this, as he said, he was doing by command of Sir Kay the Seneschal, whose prisoners they were, he having vanquished them by his single might and prowess in sturdy conflict in the field. Surprise and astonishment flashed from face to face all over the house. The queen's gratified smile faded out at the name of Sir Kay, and she looked disappointed, and the page whispered in my ear with an accent and manner expressive of extravagant derision. Sir Kay, forsooth. Oh, call me pet names, dearest, call me a marine. In 2,000 years shall the unholy invention of man labor at odds to beget the fellow to this majestic lie. Every eye was fastened with severe inquiry upon Sir Kay. But he was equal to the occasion. He got up and played his hand like a major and took every trick. He said he would state the case exactly according to the facts, he would tell the simple straightforward tale, without comment of his own, and then, said he, if ye find glory and honor due, ye will give it unto him who is the mightiest man of his hands that ever bare shield or strake with sword in the ranks of Christian battle, even him that sitteth there. And he pointed to Sir Launcelot. Ah, he fetched them, it was a rattling good stroke. Then he went on and told how Sir Launcelot, seeking adventures, some brief time gone by, killed 7 giants at one sweep of his sword, and set 142 captive maidens free, and then went further, still seeking adventures, and found him, Sir Kay, fighting a desperate fight against 9 foreign knights, and straightway took the battle solely into his own hands, and conquered the 9, and that night Sir Launcelot rose quietly, and dressed him in Sir Kay's armor and took Sir Kay's horse and gat him away into distant lands, and vanquished 16 knights in 1 pitched battle and 34 in another, and all these in the former 9 he made to swear that about Whitsuntide they would ride to Arthur's court and yield them to Queen Guinevere's hands as captives of Sir Kay the Seneschal, spoil of his knightly prowess, and now here were these 6, and the rest would be along as soon as they might be healed of their desperate wounds. Well, it was touching to see the queen blush and smile, and look embarrassed and happy, and fling furtive glances at Sir Launcelot that would have got him shot in Arkansas, to a dead certainty. Everybody praised the valor and magnanimity of Sir Launcelot, and as for me, I was perfectly amazed, that one man, all by himself, should have been able to beat down and capture such battalions of practiced fighters. I said as much to Clarence, but this mocking featherhead only said. And Sir Kay had time to get another skin of sour wine into him, ye had seen the accompt doubled. I looked at the boy in sorrow, and as I looked I saw the cloud of a deep despondency settle upon his countenance. I followed the direction of his eye, and saw that a very old and white-bearded man, clothed in a flowing black gown, had risen and was standing at the table upon unsteady legs, and feebly swaying his ancient head and surveying the company with his watery and wandering eye. The same suffering look that was in the page's face was observable in all the faces around, the look of dumb creatures who know that they must endure and make no moan. "Mary, we shall have it again," sighed the boy, "that same old weary tale that he hath told 1,000 times in the same words, and that he will tell till he dieth, every time he hath gotten his barrel full and feeleth his exaggeration mill a-working. Would God I had died or I saw this day. Who is it?" "Merlin, the mighty liar and magician. Perdition cinch him for the weariness he worketh with his one tail. But that men fear him, for that he hath the storms and the lightnings and all the devils that be in hell at his beck and call, they would have dug his entrails out these many years ago to get at that tail and squelch it. He telleth it always in the third person, making believe he is too modest to glorify himself. Maledictions light upon him, misfortune be his dole. Good friend, prithee call me for evensong." The boy nestled himself upon my shoulder and pretended to go to sleep. The old man began his tale, and presently the lad was asleep in reality, so also were the dogs, and the court, the lackeys, and the files of men-at-arms. The droning voice droned on, a soft snoring arose on all sides and supported it like a deep and subdued accompaniment of wind instruments. Some heads were bowed upon folded arms, some lay back with open mouths that issued unconscious music, the flies buzzed and bit, unmolested, the rats swarmed softly out from a hundred holes, and pattered about, and made themselves at home everywhere. And one of them sat up like a squirrel on the king's head and held a bit of cheese in its hands and nibbled it, and dribbled the crumbs in the king's face with naive and impudent irreverence. It was a tranquil scene, and restful to the weary eye and the jaded spirit. This was the old man's tale, he said. Right so the king and Merlin departed, and went until an hermit that was a good man and a great leech. So the hermit searched all his wounds and gave him good salves, so the king was there 3 days, and then were his wounds well amended that he might ride and go. And so departed. And as they rode, Arthur said, I have no sword. No force, footnote from MT, no matter, said Merlin, hereby is a sword that shall be yours and I may. So they rode till they came to a lake, the which was a fair water and broad, and in the midst of the lake Arthur was ware of an arm clothed in white samite, that held a fair sword in that hand. Lo, said Merlin, yonder is that sword that I spake of. With that they saw a damsel going upon the lake. What damsel is that? Said Arthur. That is the Lady of the Lake, said Merlin, and within that lake is a rock, and therein is as fair a place as any on earth, and richly beseen, and this damsel will come to you anon, and then speak ye fair to her that she will give you that sword. Anon withal came the damsel unto Arthur and saluted him, and he her again. Damsel, said Arthur, what sword is that, that yonder the arm holdeth above the water? I would it were mine, for I have no sword. Sir Arthur King, said the damsel, that sword is mine. And if ye will give me a gift when I ask it you, ye shall have it. By my faith, said Arthur, I will give you what gift ye will ask. Well, said the damsel, go ye into yonder barge and row yourself to the sword, and take it in the scabbard with you, and I will ask my gift when I see my time. So Sir Arthur and Merlin alight, and tied their horses to 2 trees, and so they went into the ship, and when they came to the sword that the hand held, Sir Arthur took it up by the handles, and took it with him. And the arm and the hand went under the water, and so they came unto the land and rode forth. And then Sir Arthur saw a rich pavilion. What significeth yonder pavilion? It is the knight's pavilion, said Merlin, that ye fought with last, Sir Pellinore, but he is out, he is not there, he hath ado with a knight of yours, that hight Eglame, and they have fought together, but at the last Eglame fled, and else he had been dead, and he hath chased him even to Carlion, and we shall meet with him anon in the highway. That is well said, said Arthur, now have I a sword. Now will I wage battle with him, and be avenged on him. Sir, ye shall not so, said Merlin, for the knight is weary of fighting and chasing, so that ye shall have no worship to have ado with him. Also, he will not lightly be matched of one knight living, and therefore it is my counsel, let him pass, for he shall do you good service in short time, and his sons, after his days. Also ye shall see that day in short space ye shall be right glad to give him your sister to wed. When I see him, I will do as ye advise me, said Arthur. Then Sir Arthur looked on the sword, and liked it passing well. Whether liketh you better, said Merlin, the sword or the scabbard? Me liketh better the sword, said Arthur. Ye are more unwise, said Merlin, for the scabbard is worth 10 of the sword, for while ye have the scabbard upon you ye shall never lose no blood, be ye never so sore wounded, therefore, keep well the scabbard always with you. So they rode into Carlion, and by the way they met with Sir Pellinore. But Merlin had done such a craft that Pellinore saw not Arthur, and he passed by without any words. I marvel, said Arthur, that the knight would not speak. Sir, said Merlin, he saw you not, for an he had seen you ye had not lightly departed. So they came unto Carlion, whereof his knights were passing glad. And when they heard of his adventures they marveled that he would jeopard his person so alone. But all men of worship said it was merry to be under such a chieftain that would put his person in adventure as other poor knights did. Chapter 4. Sir Dinadan the Humorist. It seemed to me that this quaint lie was most simply and beautifully told, but then I had heard it only once, and that makes a difference. It was pleasant to the others when it was fresh, no doubt. Sir Dinadan the Humorist was the first to awake, and he soon roused the rest with a practical joke of a sufficiently poor quality. He tied some metal mugs to a dog's tail and turned him loose, and he tore around and around the place in a frenzy of fright, with all the other dogs bellowing after him and battering and crashing against everything that came in their way and making altogether a chaos of confusion and a most deafening din and turmoil, at which every man and woman of the multitude laughed till the tears flowed, and some fell out of their chairs and wallowed on the floor in ecstasy. It was just like so many children. Sir Dinadan was so proud of his exploit that he could not keep from telling over and over again, to weariness, how the immortal idea happened to occur to him, and as is the way with humorists of his breed, he was still laughing at it after everybody else had got through. He was so set up that he concluded to make a speech, of course a humorous speech. I think I never heard so many old played-out jokes strung together in my life. He was worse than the minstrels, worse than the clown and the circus. It seemed peculiarly sad to sit here, 1300 years before I was born, and listen again to poor, flat, worm-eaten jokes that had given me the dry gripes when I was a boy 1300 years afterwards. It about convinced me that there isn't any such thing as a new joke possible. Everybody laughed at these antiquities, but then they always do, I had noticed that, centuries later. However, of course the scoffer didn't laugh, I mean the boy. No, he scoffed, there wasn't anything he wouldn't scoff at. He said that most of Sir Dinadan's jokes were rotten and the rest were petrified. I said petrified was good, as I believed, myself, that the only right way to classify the majestic ages of some of those jokes was by geologic periods. But that neat idea hit the boy in a blank place, for geology hadn't been invented yet. However, I made a note of the remark, and calculated to educate the Commonwealth up to it if I pulled through. It is no use to throw a good thing away merely because the market isn't ripe yet. Now Sir Kay arose and began to fire up on his history mill with me for fuel. It was time for me to feel serious, and I did. Sir Kay told how he had encountered me in a far land of barbarians, who all wore the same ridiculous garb that I did, a garb that was a work of enchantment, and intended to make the wearer secure from hurt by human hands. However, he had nullified the force of the enchantment by prayer, and had killed my 13 knights in a 3 hours battle, and taken me prisoner, sparing my life in order that so strange a curiosity as I was might be exhibited to the wonder and admiration of the king and the court. He spoke of me all the time, in the blandest way, as this prodigious giant, and this horrible sky-towering monster, and this tusked and taloned man-devouring ogre, and everybody took in all this bosh in the naivest way, and never smiled or seemed to notice that there was any discrepancy between these watered statistics and me. He said that in trying to escape from him I sprang into the top of a tree 200 cubits high at a single bound, but he dislodged me with a stone the size of a cow, which all to brass the most of my bones, and then swore me to appear at Arthur's court for sentence. He ended by condemning me to die at noon on the 21st, and was so little concerned about it that he stopped to yawn before he named the date. I was in a dismal state by this time, indeed, I was hardly enough in my right mind to keep the run of a dispute that sprung up as to how I had better be killed, the possibility of the killing being doubted by some, because of the enchantment in my clothes. And yet it was nothing but an ordinary suit of $15 slop shops. Still, I was sane enough to notice this detail, to wit, many of the terms used in the most matter-of-fact way by this great assemblage of the first ladies and gentlemen in the land would have made a Comanche blush. Indelicacy is too mild a term to convey the idea. However, I had read Tom Jones, and Roderick Random, and other books of that kind, and knew that the highest and first ladies and gentlemen in England had remained little or no cleaner in their talk, and in the morals and conduct which such talk implies, clear up to 100 years ago, in fact clear into our own 19th century, in which century, broadly speaking, the earliest samples of the real lady and real gentleman discoverable in English history or in European history, for that matter, may be said to have made their appearance. Suppose Sir Walter, instead of putting the conversations into the mouths of his characters, had allowed the characters to speak for themselves? We should have had talk from Rebecca and Ivanhoe and the soft lady Rowena, which would embarrass a tramp in our day. However, to the unconsciously indelicate all things are delicate. King Arthur's people were not aware that they were indecent, and I had presence of mind enough not to mention it. They were so troubled about my enchanted clothes that they were mightily relieved, at last, when old Merlin swept the difficulty away for them with a common sense hint. He asked them why they were so dull, why didn't it occur to them to strip me. In half a minute I was as naked as a pair of tongs. And dear, dear, to think of it, I was the only embarrassed person there. Everybody discussed me, and did it as unconcernedly as if I had been a cabbage. Queen Guinevere was as naively interested as the rest, and said she had never seen anybody with legs just like mine before. It was the only compliment I got, if it was a compliment. Finally I was carried off in one direction, and my perilous clothes in another. I was shoved into a dark and narrow cell in a dungeon, with some scant remnants for dinner, some moldy straw for a bed, and no end of rats for company. Chapter 5. An Inspiration. I was so tired that even my fears were not able to keep me awake long. When I next came to myself, I seemed to have been asleep a very long time. My first thought was, well, what an astonishing dream I've had. I reckon I've waked only just in time to keep from being hanged or drowned or burned or something. I'll nap again till the whistle blows, and then I'll go down to the arms factory and have it out with Hercules. But just then I heard the harsh music of rusty chains and bolts, a light flashed in my eyes, and that butterfly, Clarence, stood before me. I gasped with surprise, my breath almost got away from me. "What?" I said, "you here yet? Go along with the rest of the dream. Scatter." But he only laughed, in his light-hearted way, and fell to making fun of my sorry plight. "All right," I said resignedly, "let the dream go on, I'm in no hurry."
"Prithee, what dream?"
"What dream? Why, the dream that I am in Arthur's court, a person who never existed, and that I am talking to you, who are nothing but a work of the imagination."
"Oh, la, indeed. And is it a dream that you're to be burned tomorrow? Ho ho, answer me that."
The shock that went through me was distressing. I now began to reason that my situation was in the last degree serious, dream or no dream, for I knew by past experience of the lifelike intensity of dreams, that to be burned to death, even in a dream, would be very far from being a jest, and was a thing to be avoided, by any means, fair or foul, that I could contrive. So I said beseechingly,
"Ah, Clarence, good boy, only friend I've got, for you are my friend, aren't you? Don't fail me, help me to devise some way of escaping from this place.
Now do but hear thyself.
Escape?
Why, man, the quarters are in guard and keep of men-at-arms."
"No doubt, no doubt.
But how many, Clarence?
Not many, I hope?"
"Full a score. One may not hope to escape." After a pause, hesitatingly, "and there be other reasons and weightier."
"Other ones? What are they?"
"Well, they say oh, but I daren't, indeed daren't."
"Why, poor lad, what is the matter? Why do you blench? Why do you tremble so?"
"Oh, in sooth, there is need. I do want to tell you, but—"
"Come, come, be brave, be a man, speak out, there's a good lad."
He hesitated, pulled one way by desire, the other way by fear, then he stole to the door and peeped out, listening, and finally crept close to me and put his mouth to my ear and told me his fearful news in a whisper, and with all the cowering apprehension of one who was venturing upon awful ground and speaking of things whose very mention might be freighted with death. "Merlin, in his malice, has woven a spell about this dungeon, and there bides not the man in these kingdoms that would be desperate enough to essay to cross its lines with you. Now God pity me, I have told it.
Ah, be kind to me, be merciful to a poor boy who means thee well, for an thou betray me I am lost."
I laughed the only really refreshing laugh I had had for some time, and shouted, "Merlin has wrought a spell. Merlin, forsooth. That cheap old humbug, that wandering old ass. Bosh, pure bosh, the silliest bosh in the world. Why, it does seem to me that of all the childish, idiotic, chuckle-headed, chicken-livered superstitions that have, oh, damn Merlin." But Clarence had slumped to his knees before I had half finished, and he was like to go out of his mind with fright.
"Oh, beware. These are awful words. Any moment these walls may crumble upon us if you say such things. Oh, call them back before it is too late."
Now this strange exhibition gave me a good idea and set me to thinking. If everybody about here was so honestly and sincerely afraid of Merlin's pretended magic as Clarence was, certainly a superior man like me ought to be shrewd enough to contrive some way to take advantage of such a state of things. I went on thinking, and worked out a plan. Then I said,
"Get up. Pull yourself together, look me in the eye. Do you know why I laughed?
No, but for our blessed lady's sake, do it no more."
"Well, I'll tell you why I laughed. Because I'm a magician myself."
"Thou." The boy recoiled a step, and caught his breath, for the thing hit him rather sudden, but the aspect which he took on was very, very respectful. I took quick note of that. It indicated that a humbug didn't need to have a reputation in this asylum. People stood ready to take him at his word, without that. I resumed. "I've known Merlin 700 years, and he—"
"700.
"Don't interrupt me. He has died and come alive again 13 times, and traveled under a new name every time: Smith, Jones, Robinson, Jackson, Peters, Haskins, Merlin, a new alias every time he turns up. I knew him in Egypt 300 years ago, I knew him in India 500 years ago. He is always blethering around in my way, everywhere I go, he makes me tired. He don't amount to shucks, as a magician, knows some of the old common tricks, but has never got beyond the rudiments, and never will. He is well enough for the provinces one night stands in that sort of thing, you know, but dear me,
He oughtn't to set up for an expert anyway, not where there's a real artist. Now look here, Clarence, I am going to stand your friend, right along, and in return you must be mine. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to get word to the king that I am a magician myself and the supreme grand high you muckamuck and head of the tribe, at that, and I want him to be made to understand that I am just quietly arranging a little calamity here that will make the fur fly in these realms if Sir Kay's project is carried out and any harm comes to me. Will you get that to the king for me? The poor boy was in such a state that he could hardly answer me. It was pitiful to see a creature so terrified, so unnerved, so demoralized. But he promised everything, and on my side he made me promise over and over again that I would remain his friend, and never turn against him or cast any enchantments upon him. Then he worked his way out, staying himself with his hand along the wall, like a sick person. Presently this thought occurred to me, how heedless I have been. When the boy gets calm, he will wonder why a great magician like me should have begged a boy like him to help me get out of this place. He will put this and that together, and will see that I am a humbug. I worried over that heedless blunder for an hour, and called myself a great many hard names, meantime. But finally it occurred to me all of a sudden that these animals didn't reason, that they never put this and that together, that all their talk showed that they didn't know a discrepancy when they saw it. I was at rest, then. But as soon as one is at rest, in this world, off he goes on something else to worry about. It occurred to me that I had made another blunder. I had sent the boy off to alarm his betters with a threat I intending to invent a calamity at my leisure. Now the people who are the readiest and eagerest and willingest to swallow miracles are the very ones who are hungriest to see you perform them. Suppose I should be called on for a sample? Suppose I should be asked to name my calamity? Yes, I had made a blunder. I ought to have invented my calamity first. What shall I do? What can I say, to gain a little time? I was in trouble again, in the deepest kind of trouble. There's a footstep. They're coming. If I had only just a moment to think. Good, I've got it. I'm all right. You see, it was the eclipse. It came into my mind in the nick of time, how Columbus, or Cortez, or one of those people, played an eclipse as a saving trump once, on some savages, and I saw my chance. I could play it myself, now, and it wouldn't be any plagiarism, either, because I should get it in nearly 1,000 years ahead of those parties. Clarence came in, subdued, distressed, and said. I hasted the message to our liege the king, and straightway he had me to his presence. He was frightened even to the marrow, and was minded to give order for your instant enlargement, and that you be clothed in fine raiment and lodged as befitted one so great, but then came Merlin and spoiled all, for he persuaded the king that you are mad, and know not whereof you speak, and said your threat is but foolishness and idle vaporing. They disputed long, but in the end, Merlin, scoffing, said, wherefore hath he not named his brave calamity? Verily it is because he cannot. This thrust did in a most sudden sort close the king's mouth, and he could offer naught to turn the argument, and so, reluctant, and full loath to do you the discourtesy, he yet prayeth you to consider his perplexed case, as noting how the matter stands, and name the calamity if so be you have determined the nature of it and the time of its coming. Oh, prithee delay not, to delay at such a time were to double and treble the perils that already compass thee about. Oh, be thou wise, name the calamity. I allowed silence to accumulate while I got my impressiveness together, and then said. How long have I been shut up in this hole? Ye were shut up when yesterday was well spent. It is 9 of the morning now. No. Then I have slept well, sure enough. 9 in the morning now. And yet it is the very complexion of midnight, to a shade. This is the 20th, then? The 20th, yes. And I am to be burned alive tomorrow. The boy shuddered. At what hour? At high noon. Now then, I will tell you what to say. I paused, and stood over that cowering lad a whole minute in awful silence, then, in a voice deep, measured, charged with doom, I began, and rose by dramatically graded stages to my colossal climax, which I delivered in as sublime and noble a way as ever I did such a thing in my life. Go back and tell the king that at that hour I will smother the whole world in the dead blackness of midnight, I will blot out the sun, and he shall never shine again. The fruits of the earth shall rot for lack of light and warmth, and the peoples of the earth shall famish and die, to the last man. I had to carry the boy out myself, he sunk into such a collapse. I handed him over to the soldiers, and went back. Chapter 6. The Eclipse. In the stillness and the darkness, realization soon began to supplement knowledge. The mere knowledge of a fact is pale, but when you come to realize your fact, it takes on color. It is all the difference between hearing of a man being stabbed to the heart, and seeing it done. In the stillness and the darkness, the knowledge that I was in deadly danger took to itself deeper and deeper meaning all the time, a something which was realization crept inch by inch through my veins and turned me cold. But it is a blessed provision of nature that at times like these, as soon as a man's mercury has got down to a certain point there comes a revulsion, and he rallies. Hope springs up, and cheerfulness along with it, and then he is in good shape to do something for himself, if anything can be done. When my rally came, it came with a bound. I said to myself that my eclipse would be sure to save me, and make me the greatest man in the kingdom besides, and straightway my mercury went up to the top of the tube, and my solicitudes all vanished. I was as happy a man as there was in the world. I was even impatient for tomorrow to come, I so wanted to gather in that great triumph and be the center of all the nation's wonder and reverence. Besides, in a business way it would be the making of me, I knew that. Meantime there was one thing which had got pushed into the background of my mind. That was the half-conviction that when the nature of my proposed calamity should be reported to those superstitious people, it would have such an effect that they would want to compromise. So, by and by when I heard footsteps coming, that thought was recalled to me, and I said to myself, as sure as anything, it's the compromise. Well, if it is good, all right, I will accept, but if it isn't, I mean to stand my ground and play my hand for all it is worth. The door opened, and some men-at-arms appeared. The leader said, "The stake is ready. Come." The stake. The strength went out of me, and I almost fell down. It is hard to get one's breath at such a time, such lumps come into one's throat, and such gaspings, but as soon as I could speak, I said, "But this is a mistake, the execution is tomorrow." Order changed, been set forward a day. Haste thee. I was lost. There was no help for me. I was dazed, stupefied, I had no command over myself, I only wandered purposely about, like one out of his mind, so the soldiers took hold of me, and pulled me along with them, out of the cell and along the maze of underground corridors, and finally into the fierce glare of daylight in the upper world. As we stepped into the vast enclosed court of the castle I got a shock, for the first thing I saw was the stake, standing in the center, and near it the piled faggots and a monk. On all four sides of the court the seated multitudes rose rank above rank, forming sloping terraces that were rich with color. The king and the queen sat in their thrones, the most conspicuous figures there, of course. To note all this, occupied but a second. The next second Clarence had slipped from some place of concealment and was pouring news into my ear, his eyes beaming with triumph and gladness. He said, "'Tis through me the change was wrought. And main hard have I worked to do it, too. But when I revealed to them the calamity in store, and saw how mighty was the terror it did engender, then saw I also that this was the time to strike. Wherefore I diligently pretended, unto this and that and the other one, that your power against the sun could not reach its full until the morrow, and so if any would save the sun and the world, you must be slain today, while your enchantments are but in the weaving and lack potency. Odds bodikins, it was but a dull lie, a most indifferent invention, but you should have seen them seize it and swallow it, in the frenzy of their fright, as it were salvation sent from heaven, and all the while was I laughing in my sleeve the one moment, to see them so cheaply deceived, and glorifying God the next, that he was content to let the meanest of his creatures be his instrument to the saving of thy life. Ah, how happy has the matter sped! You will not need to do this on a real hurt, ah, forget not that, on your soul forget it not. Only make a little darkness, only the littlest little darkness, mind, and cease with that. It will be sufficient. They will see that I spoke falsely, being ignorant, as they will fancy, and with the falling of the first shadow of that darkness you shall see them go mad with fear, and they will set you free and make you great. Go to thy triumph, now. But remember, ah, good friend, I implore thee, remember my supplication, and do the blessed son no hurt. For my sake, thy true friend." I choked out some words through my grief and misery, as much as to say I would spare the son, for which the lad's eyes paid me back with such deep and loving gratitude that I had not the heart to tell him his good-hearted foolishness had ruined me and sent me to my death. As the soldiers assisted me across the court the stillness was so profound that if I had been blindfold I should have supposed I was in a solitude instead of walled in by 4,000 people. There was not a movement perceptible in those masses of humanity, they were as rigid as stone images, and as pale, and dread sat upon every countenance. This hush continued while I was being chained to the stake, it still continued while the faggots were carefully and tediously piled about my ankles, my knees, my thighs, my body. Then there was a pause, and a deeper hush, if possible, and a man knelt down at my feet with a blazing torch. The multitude strained forward, gazing, and parting slightly from their seats without knowing it. The monk raised his hands above my head, and his eyes toward the blue sky, and began some words in Latin. In this attitude he droned on, a little while, and then stopped. I waited 2 or 3 moments, then looked up. He was standing there petrified. With a common impulse the multitude rose slowly up and stared into the sky. I followed their eyes, as sure as guns, there was my eclipse beginning. The life went boiling through my veins, I was a new man. The rim of black spread slowly into the sun's disk, my heart beat higher and higher, and still the assemblage and the priests stared into the sky, motionless. I knew that this gaze would be turned upon me, next. When it was, I was ready. I was in one of the most grand attitudes I ever struck, with my arm stretched up pointing to the sun. It was a noble effect. You could see the shutter sweep the mass like a wave. 2 shouts rang out, one close upon the heels of the other. Apply the torch. I forbid it. The one was from Merlin, the other from the king. Merlin started from his place to apply the torch himself, I judged. I said, stay where you are. If any man moves even the king before I give him leave, I will blast him with thunder, I will consume him with lightnings. The multitude sank meekly into their seats, and I was just expecting they would. Merlin hesitated a moment or two, and I was on pins and needles during that little while. Then he sat down, and I took a good breath, for I knew I was master of the situation now. The king said, be merciful, fair sir, and essay no further in this perilous matter, lest disaster follow. It was reported to us that your powers could not attain unto their full strength until the morrow, but your majesty thinks the report may have been a lie? It was a lie. That made an immense effect, up went appealing hands everywhere, and the king was assailed with a storm of supplications that I might be bought off at any price, and the calamity stayed. The king was eager to comply. He said, name any terms, reverend sir, even to the having of my kingdom, but banish this calamity, spare the sun. My fortune was made. I would have taken him up in a minute, but I couldn't stop an eclipse, the thing was out of the question. So I asked time to consider. The king said, how long, how long, good sir? Be merciful, look, it groweth darker, moment by moment. Prithee how long? Not long. Half an hour, maybe an hour. There were 1,000 pathetic protests, but I couldn't shorten up any, for I couldn't remember how long a total eclipse lasts. I was in a puzzled condition, anyway, and wanted to think. Something was wrong about that eclipse, and the fact was very unsettling. If this wasn't the one I was after, how was I to tell whether this was the 6th century, or nothing but a dream? Dear me, if I could only prove it was the latter. Here was a glad new hope. If the boy was right about the date, and this was surely the 20th, it wasn't the 6th century. I reached for the monk's sleeve, in considerable excitement, and asked him what day of the month it was. Hang him, he said it was the 21st. It made me turn cold to hear him. I begged him not to make any mistake about it, but he was sure, he knew it was the 21st. So, that feather-headed boy had botched things again. The time of the day was right for the eclipse, I had seen that for myself, in the beginning, by the dial that was nearby. Yes, I was in King Arthur's court, and I might as well make the most out of it I could. The darkness was steadily growing, the people becoming more and more distressed. I now said, I have reflected, Sir King. For a lesson, I will let this darkness proceed, and spread night in the world, but whether I blot out the sun for good, or restore it, shall rest with you. These are the terms, to wit, you shall remain king over all your dominions, and receive all the glories and honors that belong to the kingship, but you shall appoint me your perpetual minister and executive, and give me for my services 1% of such actual increase of revenue over and above its present amount as I may succeed in creating for the state. If I can't live on that, I shan't ask anybody to give me a lift. Is it satisfactory? There was a prodigious roar of applause, and out of the midst of it the king's voice rose, saying, away with his bonds, and set him free. And do him homage, high and low, rich and poor, for he has become the king's right hand, is clothed with power and authority, and his seat is upon the highest step of the throne. Now sweep away this creeping night, and bring the light and cheer again, that all the world may bless thee. But I said, that a common man should be shamed before the world, is nothing, but it were dishonor to the king if any that saw his minister naked should not also see him delivered from his shame. If I might ask that my clothes be brought again. They are not meet, the king broke in. Fetch raiment of another sort, clothe him like a prince. My idea worked. I wanted to keep things as they were till the eclipse was total, otherwise they would be trying again to get me to dismiss the darkness, and of course I couldn't do it. Sending for the clothes gained some delay, but not enough. So I had to make another excuse. I said it would be but natural if the king should change his mind and repent to some extent of what he had done under excitement, therefore I would let the darkness grow a while, and if at the end of a reasonable time the king had kept his mind the same, the darkness should be dismissed. Neither the king nor anybody else was satisfied with that arrangement, but I had to stick to my point. It grew darker and darker and blacker, while I struggled with those awkward 6th-century clothes. It got to be pitch dark, at last, and the multitude groaned with horror to feel the cold uncanny night breezes fan through the place and see the stars come out and twinkle in the sky. At last the eclipse was total, and I was very glad of it, but everybody else was in misery, which was quite natural. I said, "The king, by his silence, still stands to the terms." Then I lifted up my hand, stood just so a moment, then I said, with the most awful solemnity, "Let the enchantment dissolve and pass harmless away." There was no response, for a moment, in that deep darkness and the graveyard hush. But when the silver rim of the sun pushed itself out, a moment or two later, the assemblage broke loose with a vast shout and came pouring down like a deluge to smother me with blessings and gratitude, and Clarence was not the last of the wash, to be sure. Chapter 7. Merlin's Tower. Inasmuch as I was now the second personage in the kingdom, as far as political power and authority were concerned, much was made of me. My raiment was of silks and velvets and cloth of gold, and by consequence was very showy, also uncomfortable. But habit would soon reconcile me to my clothes, I was aware of that. I was given the choicest suite of apartments in the castle, after the king's. They were aglow with loud-colored silken hangings, but the stone floors had nothing but rushes on them for a carpet, and they were misfit rushes at that, being not all of one breed. As for conveniences, properly speaking, there weren't any. I mean little conveniences, it is the little conveniences that make the real comfort of life. The big oaken chairs, graced with rude carvings, were well enough, but that was the stopping place. There was no soap, no matches, no looking glass except a metal one, about as powerful as a pail of water. And not a chromo. I had been used to chromos for years, and I saw now that without my suspecting it, a passion for art had got worked into the fabric of my being, and was become a part of me. It made me homesick to look around over this proud and gaudy but heartless barrenness and remember that in our house in East Hartford, all unpretending as it was, you couldn't go into a room but you would find an insurance chromo, or at least a three-color God bless our home over the door, and in the parlor we had 9. But here, even in my grand room of state, there wasn't anything in the nature of a picture except a thing the size of a bed quilt, which was either woven or knitted, it had darned places in it, and nothing in it was the right color or the right shape, and as for proportions, even Raphael himself couldn't have botched them more formidably, after all his practice on those nightmares they call his celebrated Hampton Court cartoons. Raphael was a bird. We had several of his chromos. One was his miraculous draft of fishes, where he puts in a miracle of his own, puts 3 men into a canoe which wouldn't have held a dog without upsetting. I always admired to study ours art, it was so fresh and unconventional. There wasn't even a bell or a speaking tube in the castle. I had a great many servants, and those that were on duty lolled in the anteroom, and when I wanted one of them I had to go and call for him. There was no gas, there were no candles, a bronze dish half full of boarding house butter with a blazing rag floating in it was the thing that produced what was regarded as light. A lot of these hung along the walls and modified the dark, just toned it down enough to make it dismal. If you went out at night, your servants carried torches. There were no books, pens, paper or ink, and no glass in the openings they believed to be windows. It is a little thing glass is until it is absent, then it becomes a big thing. But perhaps the worst of all was, that there wasn't any sugar, coffee, tea, or tobacco. I saw that I was just another Robinson Crusoe cast away on an uninhabited island, with no society but some more or less tame animals, and if I wanted to make life bearable I must do as he did: invent, contrive, create, reorganize things, set brain and hand to work, and keep them busy. Well, that was in my line. One thing troubled me along at first: the immense interest which people took in me. Apparently the whole nation wanted a look at me. It soon transpired that the eclipse had scared the British world almost to death, that while it lasted the whole country, from one end to the other, was in a pitiable state of panic, and the churches, hermitages, and monkeries overflowed with praying and weeping poor creatures who thought the end of the world was come. Then had followed the news that the producer of this awful event was a stranger, a mighty magician at Arthur's court, that he could have blown out the sun like a candle, and was just going to do it when his mercy was purchased, and he then dissolved his enchantments, and was now recognized and honored as the man who had by his unaided might save the globe from destruction and its peoples from extinction. Now if you consider that everybody believed that, and not only believed it, but never even dreamed of doubting it, You will easily understand that there was not a person in all Britain that would not have walked 50 miles to get a sight of me. Of course I was all the talk, all other subjects were dropped, even the king became suddenly a person of minor interest and notoriety. Within 24 hours the delegations began to arrive, and from that time onward for a fortnight they kept coming. The village was crowded, and all the countryside. I had to go out a dozen times a day and show myself to these reverent and awe-stricken multitudes. It came to be a great burden, as to time and trouble, but of course it was at the same time compensatingly agreeable to be so celebrated and such a center of homage. It turned Brer Merlin green with envy and spite, which was a great satisfaction to me. But there was one thing I couldn't understand. Nobody had asked for an autograph. I spoke to Clarence about it. By George, I had to explain to him what it was. Then he said nobody in the country could read or write but a few dozen priests. Land. Think of that. There was another thing that troubled me a little. Those multitudes presently began to agitate for another miracle. That was natural. To be able to carry back to their far homes the boast that they had seen the man who could command the sun, riding in the heavens, and be obeyed, would make them great in the eyes of their neighbors, and envied by them all, but to be able to also say they had seen him work a miracle of themselves, why, people would come a distance to see them. The pressure got to be pretty strong. There was going to be an eclipse of the moon, and I knew the date and hour, but it was too far away. 2 years. I would have given a good deal for a license to hurry it up and use it now when there was a big market for it. It seemed a great pity to have it wasted so, and come lagging along at a time when a body wouldn't have any use for it, as like as not. If it had been booked for only a month away, I could have sold it short, but, as matters stood, I couldn't seem to cipher out any way to make it do me any good, so I gave up trying. Next, Clarence found that old Merlin was making himself busy on the sly among those people. He was spreading a report that I was a humbug, and that the reason I didn't accommodate the people with a miracle was because I couldn't. I saw that I must do something. I presently thought out a plan. By my authority as executive I threw Merlin into prison, the same cell I had occupied myself. Then I gave public notice by herald and trumpet that I should be busy with affairs of state for a fortnight, but about the end of that time I would take a moment's leisure and blow up Merlin's stone tower by fires from heaven. In the meantime, whoso listened to evil reports about me, let him beware. Furthermore, I would perform but this one miracle at this time, and no more. If it failed to satisfy and any murmured, I would turn the murmurers into horses, and make them useful. Quiet ensued. I took Clarence into my confidence, to a certain degree, and we went to work privately. I told him that this was a sort of miracle that required a trifle of preparation, and that it would be sudden death to ever talk about these preparations to anybody. That made his mouth safe enough. Clandestinely we made a few bushels of first-rate blasting powder, and I superintended my armorers while they constructed a lightning rod and some wires. This old stone tower was very massive and rather ruinous, too, for it was Roman, and 400 years old. Yes, and handsome, after a rude fashion, and clothed with ivy from base to summit, as with a shirt of scale mail. It stood on a lonely eminence, in good view from the castle, and about half a mile away. Working by night, we stowed the powder in the tower, dug stones out, on the inside, and buried the powder in the walls themselves, which were 15 feet thick at the base. We put in a peck at a time, in a dozen places. We could have blown up the Tower of London with these charges. When the 13th night was come we put up our lightning rod, bedded it in one of the batches of powder, and ran wires from it to the other batches. Everybody had shunned that locality from the day of my proclamation, but on the morning of the 14th I thought best to warn the people, through the heralds, to keep clear away a quarter of a mile away. Then added, by command, that at some time during the 24 hours I would consummate the miracle, but would first give a brief notice, by flags on the castle towers if in the daytime, by torch baskets in the same places if at night. Thundershowers had been tolerably frequent of late, and I was not much afraid of a failure. Still, I shouldn't have cared for a delay of a day or two. I should have explained that I was busy with affairs of state yet, and the people must wait. Of course, we had a blazing sunny day, almost the first one without a cloud for 3 weeks. Things always happen so. I kept secluded, and watched the weather. Clarence dropped in from time to time and said the public excitement was growing and growing all the time, and the whole country filling up with human masses as far as one could see from the battlements. At last the wind sprang up and a cloud appeared in the right quarter, too, and just at nightfall. For a little while I watched that distant cloud spread and blacken, then I judged it was time for me to appear. I ordered the torch baskets to be lit, and Merlin liberated and sent to me. A quarter of an hour later I ascended the parapet and there found the king and the court assembled and gazing off in the darkness toward Merlin's tower. Already the darkness was so heavy that one could not see far, these people in the old turrets, being partly in deep shadow and partly in the red glow from the great torch baskets overhead, made a good deal of a picture. Merlin arrived in a gloomy mood. I said, "You wanted to burn me alive when I had not done you any harm, and latterly you have been trying to injure my professional reputation. Therefore I am going to call down fire and blow up your tower, but it is only fair to give you a chance. Now if you think you can break my enchantments and ward off the fires, step to the bat, it's your innings." "I can, fair sir, and I will. Doubt it not." He drew an imaginary circle on the stones of the roof, and burned a pinch of powder in it, which sent up a small cloud of aromatic smoke, whereat everybody fell back and began to cross themselves and get uncomfortable. Then he began to mutter and make passes in the air with his hands. He worked himself up slowly and gradually into a sort of frenzy, and got to thrashing around with his arms like the sails of a windmill. By this time the storm had about reached us, the gusts of wind were flaring the torches and making the shadows swash about, the first heavy drops of rain were falling, the world abroad was black as pitch, the lightning began to wink fitfully. Of course, my rod would be loading itself now. In fact, things were imminent. So I said, "You have had time enough. I have given you every advantage, and not interfered. It is plain your magic is weak. It is only fair that I begin now." I made about three passes in the air, and then there was an awful crash and that old tower leapt into the sky in chunks, along with a vast volcanic fountain of fire that turned night to noonday, and showed 1,000 acres of human beings groveling on the ground in a general collapse of consternation. Well, it rained mortar and masonry the rest of the week. This was the report, but probably the facts would have modified it. It was an effective miracle. The great bothersome temporary population vanished. There were a good many thousand tracks in the mud the next morning, but they were all outward bound. If I had advertised another miracle, I couldn't have raised an audience with a sheriff. Merlin's stock was flat. The king wanted to stop his wages, he even wanted to banish him, but I interfered. I said he would be useful to work the weather, and attend to small matters like that, and I would give him a lift now and then when his poor little parlor magic soured on him. There wasn't a rag of his tower left, but I had the government rebuild it for him, and advised him to take boarders, but he was too high-toned for that. And as for being grateful, he never even said thank you. He was a rather hard lot. Take him how you might, but then you couldn't fairly expect a man to be sweet that had been set back so. Chapter 8. The Boss. To be vested with enormous authority is a fine thing, but to have the onlooking world consent to it is a finer. The tower episode solidified my power, and made it impregnable. If any were perchance disposed to be jealous and critical before that, they experienced a change of heart, now. There was not anyone in the kingdom who would have considered it good judgment to meddle with my matters. I was fast getting adjusted to my situation and circumstances. For a time, I used to wake up, mornings, and smile at my dream, and listen for the Colt's factory whistle, but that sort of thing played itself out, gradually, and at last I was fully able to realize that I was actually living in the 6th century, and in Arthur's court, not a lunatic asylum. After that, I was just as much at home in that century as I could have been in any other, and as for preference, I wouldn't have traded it for the 20th. Look at the opportunities here for a man of knowledge, brains, pluck, and enterprise to sail in and grow up with the country. The grandest field that ever was, and all my own. Not a competitor, not a man who wasn't a baby to me in acquirements and capacities, whereas, what would I amount to in the 20th century? I should be foreman of a factory, that is about all, and could drag a seine down street any day and catch 100 better men than myself. What a jump I had made. I couldn't keep from thinking about it, and contemplating it, just as one does who has struck oil. There was nothing back of me that could approach it, unless it might be Joseph's case, and Joseph's only approached it, it didn't equal it, quite. For it stands to reason that as Joseph's splendid financial ingenuities advantaged nobody but the king, the general public must have regarded him with a good deal of disfavor, whereas I had done my entire public a kindness in sparing the sun, and was popular by reason of it. I was no shadow of a king, I was the substance, the king himself was the shadow. My power was colossal, and it was not a mere name, as such things have generally been, it was the genuine article. I stood here, at the very spring and source of the second great period of the world's history, and could see the trickling stream of that history gather and deepen and broaden, and roll its mighty tides down the far centuries, and I could note the upspringing of adventurers like myself in the shelter of its long array of thrones, de Mountforts, Gavestons, Mortimers, Villiers, the war-making, campaign-directing wantons of France, and Charles II's scepter-wielding drabs, but nowhere in the procession was my full-sized fellow visible. I was a unique, and glad to know that that fact could not be dislodged or challenged for 13 centuries and a half, for sure. Yes, in power I was equal to the king. At the same time there was another power that was a trifle stronger than both of us put together. That was the church. I do not wish to disguise that fact. I couldn't, if I wanted to. But never mind about that, now, it will show up, in its proper place, later on. It didn't cause me any trouble in the beginning, at least any of consequence. Well, it was a curious country, and full of interest. And the people. They were the quaintest and simplest and trustingest race. Why, they were nothing but rabbits. It was pitiful for a person born in a wholesome free atmosphere to listen to their humble and hearty outpourings of loyalty toward their king and church and nobility, as if they had any more occasion to love and honor king and church and noble than a slave has to love and honor the lash, or a dog has to love and honor the stranger that kicks him. Why, dear me, any kind of royalty, howsoever modified, any kind of aristocracy, howsoever pruned, is rightly an insult, but if you were born and brought up under that sort of arrangement you probably never find it out for yourself, and don't believe it when somebody else tells you. It is enough to make a body ashamed of his race to think of the sort of froth that has always occupied its thrones without shadow of right or reason, and the seventh-rate people that have always figured as its aristocracies a company of monarchs and nobles who, as a rule, would have achieved only poverty and obscurity if left, like their betters, to their own exertions. The most of King Arthur's British nation were slaves, pure and simple, and bore that name, and wore the iron collar on their necks, and the rest were slaves in fact, but without the name, they imagined themselves men and freemen, and called themselves so. The truth was, the nation as a body was in the world for one object, and one only, to grovel before king and church and noble, to slave for them, sweat blood for them, starve that they might be fed, work that they might play, drink misery to the dregs that they might be happy, go naked that they might wear silks and jewels, pay taxes that they might be spared from paying them, be familiar all their lives with the degrading language and postures of adulation that they might walk in pride and think themselves the gods of this world. And for all this, the thanks they got were cuffs and contempt, and so poor-spirited were they that they took even this sort of attention as an honor. Inherited ideas are a curious thing, and interesting to observe and examine. I had mine, the king and his people had theirs. In both cases they flowed in ruts worn deep by time and habit, and the man who should have proposed to divert them by reason and argument would have had a long contract on his hands. For instance, those people had inherited the idea that all men without title and a long pedigree, whether they had great natural gifts and acquirements or hadn't, were creatures of no more consideration than so many animals, bugs, insects, whereas I had inherited the idea that human daws who can consent to masquerade in the peacock shams of inherited dignities and unearned titles, are of no good but to be laughed at. The way I was looked upon was odd, but it was natural. You know how the keeper and the public regard the elephant in the menagerie? Well, that is the idea. They are full of admiration of his vast bulk and his prodigious strength, they speak with pride of the fact that he can do 100 marvels which are far and away beyond their own powers, and they speak with the same pride of the fact that in his wrath he is able to drive 1,000 men before him. But does that make him one of them? No, the raggedest tramp in the pit would smile at the idea. He couldn't comprehend it, couldn't take it in, couldn't in any remote way conceive of it. Well, to the king, the nobles, and all the nation, down to the very slaves and tramps, I was just that kind of an elephant, and nothing more. I was admired, also feared, but it was as an animal as admired and feared. The animal is not reverenced, neither was I was not even respected. I had no pedigree, no inherited title, so in the king's and nobles' eyes I was mere dirt. The people regarded me with wonder and awe, but there was no reverence mixed with it. Through the force of inherited ideas they were not able to conceive of anything being entitled to that except pedigree and lordship. There you see the hand of that awful power, the Roman Catholic Church. In 2 or 3 little centuries it had converted a nation of men to a nation of worms. Before the day of the Church's supremacy in the world, men were men, and held their heads up, and had a man's pride and spirit and independence, and what of greatness and position a person got, he got mainly by achievement, not by birth. But then the Church came to the front, with an axe to grind, and she was wise, subtle, and knew more than one way to skin a cat or a nation. She invented divine right of kings, and propped it all around, brick by brick, with the Beatitudes, wrenching them from their good purpose to make them fortify an evil one. She preached, to the commoner, humility, obedience to superiors, the beauty of self-sacrifice. She preached, to the commoner, meekness under insult, preached, still to the commoner, always to the commoner, patience, meanness of spirit, non-resistance under oppression, and she introduced heritable ranks and aristocracies, and taught all the Christian populations of the earth to bow down to them and worship them. Even down to my birth century, that poison was still in the blood of Christendom, and the best of English commoners was still content to see his inferiors impudently continuing to hold a number of positions, such as lordships and the throne, to which the grotesque laws of his country did not allow him to aspire. In fact, he was not merely contented with this strange condition of things, he was even able to persuade himself that he was proud of it. It seems to show that there isn't anything you can't stand, if you are only born and bred to it. Of course that taint, that reverence for rank and title, had been in our American blood, too, I know that, but when I left America it had disappeared at least to all intents and purposes. The remnant of it was restricted to the dudes and duddesses. When a disease has worked its way down to that level, it may fairly be said to be out of the system. But to return to my anomalous position in King Arthur's kingdom. Here I was, a giant among pygmies, a man among children, a master intelligence among intellectual moles, by all rational measurement the one and only actually great man in that whole British world, and yet there and then, just as in the remote England of my birth time, the sheep-witted earl who could claim long descent from a king's leman, acquired at second hand from the slums of London, was a better man than I was. Such a personage was fawned upon in Arthur's realm and reverently looked up to by everybody, even though his dispositions were as mean as his intelligence, and his morals as base as his lineage. There were times when he could sit down in the king's presence, but I couldn't. I could have got a title easily enough, and that would have raised me a large step in everybody's eyes, even in the king's, the giver of it. But I didn't ask for it, and I declined it when it was offered. I couldn't have enjoyed such a thing with my notions, and it wouldn't have been fair, anyway, because as far back as I could go, our tribe had always been short of the bar sinister. I couldn't have felt really and satisfactorily fine and proud and set up over any title except one that should come from the nation itself, the only legitimate source, and such an one I hoped to win, and in the course of years of honest and honorable endeavor, I did win it and did wear it with a high and clean pride. This title fell casually from the lips of a blacksmith, one day, in a village, was caught up as a happy thought and tossed from mouth to mouth with a laugh and an affirmative vote. In 10 days it had swept the kingdom, and was become as familiar as the king's name. I was never known by any other designation afterward, whether in the nation's talk or in grave debate upon matters of state at the council board of the sovereign. This title, translated into modern speech, would be the boss. Elected by the nation. That suited me. And it was a pretty high title. There were very few these, and I was one of them. If you spoke of the duke, or the earl, or the bishop, how could anybody tell which one you meant? But if you spoke of the king or the queen or the boss, it was different. Well, I liked the king, and as king I respected him, respected the office, at least respected it as much as I was capable of respecting any unearned supremacy, but as men I looked down upon him and his nobles privately. And he and they liked me, and respected my office, but as an animal, without birth or sham title, they looked down upon me and were not particularly private about it, either. I didn't charge for my opinion about them, and they didn't charge for their opinion about me. The account was square, the books balanced, everybody was satisfied. Chapter 9. The Tournament. They were always having grand tournaments there at Camelot, and very stirring and picturesque and ridiculous human bullfights they were, too, but just a little wearisome to the practical mind. However, I was generally on hand for two reasons. A man must not hold himself aloof from the things which his friends and his community have at heart if he would be liked, especially as a statesman, and both as businessman and statesman I wanted to study the tournament and see if I couldn't invent an improvement on it. That reminds me to remark, in passing, that the very first official thing I did, in my administration, and it was on the very first day of it, too, was to start a patent office, for I knew that a country without a patent office and good patent laws was just a crab, and couldn't travel any way but sideways or backways. Things ran along, a tournament nearly every week, and now and then the boys used to want me to take a hand, I mean Sir Launcelot and the rest, but I said I would by and by, no hurry yet, and too much government machinery to oil up and set to rights and start a going. We had one tournament which was continued from day to day during more than a week, and as many as 500 knights took part in it, from first to last. They were weeks gathering. They came on horseback from everywhere, from the very ends of the country, and even from beyond the sea, and many brought ladies, and all brought squires and troops of servants. It was a most gaudy and gorgeous crowd, as to costumery, and very characteristic of the country and the time, in the way of high animal spirits, innocent indecencies of language, and happy-hearted indifference to morals. It was fight or look on, all day and every day, and sing, gamble, dance, carouse half the night every night. They had a most noble good time. You never saw such people. Those banks of beautiful ladies, shining in their barbaric splendors, would see a knight sprawl from his horse in the lists with a lance shaft the thickness of your ankle clean through him and the blood spouting, and instead of fainting they would clap their hands and crowd each other for a better view, only sometimes one would dive into her handkerchief, and look ostentatiously broken-hearted, and then you could lay 2-1 that there was a scandal there somewhere and she was afraid the public hadn't found it out. The noise at night would have been annoying to me ordinarily, but I didn't mind it in the present circumstances, because it kept me from hearing the quacks detaching legs and arms from the day's cripples. They ruined an uncommon good old crosscut saw for me, and broke the sawbuck, too, but I let it pass. And as for my axe, well, I made up my mind that the next time I lent an axe to a surgeon I would pick my century. I not only watched this tournament from day to day, but detailed an intelligent priest from my Department of Public Morals and Agriculture, and ordered him to report it, for it was my purpose by and by, when I should have gotten the people along far enough, to start a newspaper. The first thing you want in a new country, is a patent office, then work up your school system, and after that, out with your paper. A newspaper has its faults, and plenty of them, but no matter, it's hark from the tomb for a dead nation, and don't you forget it. You can't resurrect a dead nation without it, there isn't any way. So I wanted to sample things, and be finding out what sort of reporter material I might be able to rake together out of the 6th century when I should come to need it. Well, the priest did very well, considering. He got in all the details, and that is a good thing in a local item. You see, he had kept books for the undertaker department of his church when he was younger, and there, you know, the money's in the details, the more details, the more swag, bearers, mutes, candles, prayers, everything counts, and if the bereaved don't buy prayers enough you mark up your candles with a forked pencil, and your bill shows up all right. And he had a good knack at getting in the complimentary thing here and there about a knight that was likely to advertise. No, I mean a knight that had influence, and he also had a neat gift of exaggeration, for in his time he had kept door for a pious hermit who lived in a sty and worked miracles. Of course this novice's report lacked whoop and crash and lurid description, and therefore wanted the true ring, but its antique wording was quaint and sweet and simple, and full of the fragrances and flavors of the time, and these little merits made up in a measure for its more important lacks. Here is an extract from it. Then Sir Brian de la Isles and Grummer Grummersome, knights of the castle, encountered with Sir Aglovale and Sir Tor, and Sir Tor smote down Sir Grummer Grummersome to the earth. Then came Sir Carados of the Dolorous Tower, and Sir Turquine, knights of the castle, and there encountered with them Sir Percival de Galis and Sir Lamorak de Galis, that were two brethren, and there encountered Sir Percival with Sir Carados, and either brake their spears unto their hands, and then Sir Turquine with Sir Lamorak, and either of them smote down other, horse and all, to the earth, and either parties rescued other and horsed them again. And Sir Arnold, and Sir Gouter, knights of the castle, encountered with Sir Brandiles and Sir Kay, and these four knights encountered mightily, and brake their spears to their hands. Then came Sir Pertilope from the castle, and there encountered with him Sir Lionel, and there Sir Pertilope the Green Knight smote down Sir Lionel, brother to Sir Launcelot. All this was marked by noble heralds, who bear him best, and their names. Then Sir Bleoberis brake his spear upon Sir Gareth, but of that stroke Sir Bleoberis fell to the earth. When Sir Galahodin saw that, he bade Sir Gareth keep him, and Sir Gareth smote him to the earth. Then Sir Galahad gat a spear to avenge his brother, and in the same wise Sir Gareth served him, and Sir Dinadan and his brother-law Coatmail Tyla, and Sir Sagramor le Disiris, and Sir Dodonala Savage, all these he bare down with one spear. When King Ascence of Ireland saw Sir Gareth fare so he marvelled what he might be, that one time seemed green, and another time, at his again coming, he seemed blue. And thus at every course that he rode to and fro he changed his colour, so that there might neither king nor knight have ready cognizance of him. Then Sir Agwisance the King of Ireland encountered with Sir Gareth, and there Sir Gareth smote him from his horse, saddle and all. And then came King Carados of Scotland, and Sir Gareth smote him down horse and man. And in the same wise he served King Uriens of the land of Gore. And then there came in Sir Bagdemagus, and Sir Gareth smote him down horse and man to the earth. And Bagdemagus's son Meliganus brake a spear upon Sir Gareth mightily and knightly. And then Sir Galahalt the noble prince cried on high, Knight with the many colours, well hast thou jested, now make thee ready that I may jest with thee. Sir Gareth heard him, and he gat a great spear, and so they encountered together, and there the prince brake his spear, but Sir Gareth smote him upon the left side of the helm, that he reeled here and there, and he had fallen down had not his men recovered him. Truly, said King Arthur, that knight with the many colours is a good knight. Wherefore the king called unto him Sir Launcelot, and prayed him to encounter with that knight. "Sir," said Launcelot, "I may as well find in my heart for to forbear him at this time, for he hath had travail enough this day, and when a good knight doth so well upon some day, it is no good knight's part to let him of his worship, and, namely, when he seeth a knight hath done so great labor, for peradventure," said Sir Launcelot, "his quarrel is here this day, and peradventure he is best beloved with his lady of all that be here, for I see well he paineth himself and enforceth him to do great deeds, and therefore," said Sir Launcelot, "as for me, this day he shall have the honor, though it lay in my power to put him from it, I would not." There was an unpleasant little episode that day, which for reasons of state I struck out of my priest's report. You will have noticed that Gary was doing some great fighting in the engagement. When I say Gary, I mean Sir Gareth. Gary was my private pet name for him. It suggests that I had a deep affection for him, and that was the case. But it was a private pet name only, and never spoken aloud to anyone, much less to him. Being a noble, he would not have endured a familiarity like that from me. Well, to proceed, I sat in the private box set apart for me as the king's minister. While Sir Dinadan was waiting for his turn to enter the lists, he came in there and sat down and began to talk, for he was always making up to me, because I was a stranger and he liked to have a fresh market for his jokes, the most of them having reached that stage of where the teller has to do the laughing himself while the other person looks sick. I had always responded to his efforts as well as I could, and felt a very deep and real kindness for him, too, for the reason that if by malice of fate he knew the one particular anecdote which I had heard oftenest and had most hated and most loathed all my life, he had at least spared it me. It was one which I had heard attributed to every humorous person who had ever stood on American soil, from Columbus down to Artemus Ward. It was about a humorous lecturer who flooded an ignorant audience with the killingest jokes for an hour and never got a laugh, and then when he was leaving, some gray simpletons wrung him gratefully by the hand and said it had been the funniest thing they had ever heard, and it was all they could do to keep from laughing right out in meetin'. That anecdote never saw the day that it was worth the telling, and yet I'd sat under the telling of it hundreds and thousands and millions and billions of times, and cried and cursed all the way through. Then who can hope to know what my feelings were, to hear this armor-plated ass starting on it again, in the murky twilight of tradition, before the dawn of history, while even Lactantius might be referred to as the late Lactantius, and the Crusades wouldn't be born for 500 years yet? Just as he finished, the call boy came, so, ha-haing like a demon, he went rattling and clanking out like a crate of loose castings, and I knew nothing more. It was some minutes before I came to, and then I opened my eyes just in time to see Sir Gareth fetch him an awful welt, and I unconsciously out with the prayer, "I hope to gracious he's killed." But by ill luck, before I had got half through with the words, Sir Gareth crashed into Sir Sagramore le Desirous and sent him thundering over his horse's crupper, and Sir Sagramore caught my remark and thought I meant it for him. Well, whenever one of those people got a thing into his head, there was no getting it out again. I knew that, so I saved my breath, and offered no explanations. As soon as Sir Sagramore got well, he notified me that there was a little account to settle between us, and he named a day 3 or 4 years in the future, place of settlement, the lists where the offense had been given. I said I would be ready when he got back. You see, he was going for the Holy Grail. The boys all took a flyer at the Holy Grail now and then. It was a several years' cruise. They always put in the long absence snooping around, in the most conscientious way, though none of them had any idea where the Holy Grail really was, and I don't think any of them actually expected to find it, or would have known what to do with it if he had run across it. You see, it was just the Northwest Passage of that day, as you may say, that was all. Every year expeditions went out holy grailing, and next year relief expeditions went out to hunt for them. There was worlds of reputation in it, but no money. Why, they actually wanted me to put in. Well, I should smile. Chapter 10. Beginnings of Civilization. The Round Table soon heard of the challenge, and of course it was a good deal discussed, for such things interested the boys. The king thought I ought now to set forth in quest of adventures, so that I might gain renown and be the more worthy to meet Sir Sagramore when the several years should have rolled away. I excused myself for the present. I said it would take me 3 or 4 years yet to get things well fixed up and going smoothly, then I should be ready. All the chances were that at the end of that time Sir Sagramore would still be out grailing, so no valuable time would be lost by the postponement. I should then have been in office 6 or 7 years, and I believed my system and machinery would be so well developed that I could take a holiday without its working any harm. I was pretty well satisfied with what I had already accomplished. In various quiet nooks and corners I had the beginnings of all sorts of industries underway, nuclei of future vast factories, the iron and steel missionaries of my future civilization. In these were gathered together the brightest young minds I could find, and I kept agents out raking the country for more, all the time. I was training a crowd of ignorant folk into experts in every sort of handiwork and scientific calling. These nurseries of mine went smoothly and privately along undisturbed in their obscure country retreats, for nobody was allowed to come into their precincts without a special permit, for I was afraid of the church. I had started a teacher factory and a lot of Sunday